Welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club. But we'll make an exception in your case. Hello, I'm Nicola Cairncross. Welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. Today, I'm joined by the whole gang, Teresa, Linda, Heather, Pat and Steph.
Hi.
This week on Write Club, Linda's going to read from her work in progress. Heather is going to share her word of the week. And then Linda will lead a mini workshop on transitions in writing. And we're going to hear what Pat and Neil Fawcett, the poet and artist, are reading at the moment. But first, Teresa is going to ask us to
name the novel.
Okay, everybody ready with a pen?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Clue number one. In this 1938 novel, the narrator is never named and the eponymous character never appears. Okay, I know you did. Just plain dumb. Clue two, shall we go on to?
I think so, yeah.
It's a novel.
So, clue two. A naive young woman is in Monte Carlo as paid companion to a wealthy American woman.
Ooh.
When she meets and falls in love, I think Linda's got it, with a rich older Englishman. Oh. They marry after a whirlwind romance.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I can't remember the title. I get it.
Oh. Okay, Pat's got it. I'll give you, I think you'll get it from the third clue. Mm-hmm. The famous first sentence, and Stephanie will like this, is an iambic pentameter. And this is how it goes. Last night I dreamt I went to Mandeville again.
Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier.
Yeah.
Just recently found out. I watched it and I couldn't remember the name of it.
I don't know if she has a name in the film, but the narrator never has a name. The main character doesn't have a name.
Yeah.
And, of course, Rebecca is dead before the novel starts, so she doesn't appear.
Mm.
But who did you think was most memorable in the film or the book?
The eponymous character.
Mrs. Danvers.
Mrs. Danvers, the evil housekeeper.
So, yes.
Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier. And her father was the actor Gerald du Maurier, and her grandfather, George du Maurier, wrote the novel Trilby, which introduced the mesmerist Svengali to the public imagination.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very good.
I love Daphne du Maurier.
Mm-hmm.
I really like
her. I remember reading Rebecca when I was very young. And it had quite an impression on me.
Yes, I must have been very young when I left him. I've not lived with him for a long time.
Worth revisiting, perhaps.
Yes.
Along with all our other Sudokus.
Yes, Sudokus. What are they called?
Ballycovers.
There's a Japanese word, isn't there, for all the books you haven't read yet as well.
It's not
Sendoku. Sendoku. Thank you, Teresa. There are some characters in books that just grab you by the throat and won't let you go. Mary Magdalene is one of those. Old and wise beyond her years, she's funny, feisty and fearless. This week, she reaches an important point in her and Eli's journey.
Thank you. Thank you, Nicola. Yeah, today it's crossing the state line. Back on the road, Eli kept his eyes to the front and worried the toothpick he held between his teeth. He would roll it from one side of his mouth to the other, stop, nibble a bit, roll it around again. He reminded Mary Magdalene of Aunt Sugar's cat, Chitlins, cleaning her fur, had that same rhythm. The sweltering air ruffled the mat spread across her lap. The local roads tangled and snarled around the state roads, all going somewhere, but she was only interested in finding the ones that led to Little Rock. Surely there was a shortcut somewhere. She wished Eli would say something. He had been uncommonly quiet since last night. She hadn't meant to hurt his feelings, but all that scared, mad, anxious emotion balled up inside her exploded into a real hissy fit. How could he be so careless as to have lost all their money? Not only had he put her entire future at risk, which he had, but he hadn't yet figured a way to earn more, at least not that he could say. Now she wanted him to snap out of it, but she was not going to apologize or take back a thing she said because he needed to hear it. Still, riding alongside him this morning was about as much fun as sitting up with the dead. She studied the map some more. Eli, did you know the shape of West Virginia on the map looks almost exactly like a frog that's been squashed flat and left to dry on the highway? She tilted the map a little to the left. The only thing that's off is the left hind leg. It's too skinny. Must have got broke off when it got squashed. Eli did not respond. She threw her head back and sighed loudly, then went back to studying the map. It shouldn't be too much farther to the state line. Eli, I wish you would perk up. You look like the cheese slid off your cracker. Eli put his head out the window and tried to spit out the toothpick. He was still working on getting the pieces off his lip when Mary Magdalene yelled, slow down, Eli, slow down. Startled, Eli hit the brake and swerved onto the shoulder, with the trailer shuddering along behind. There it is, Eli, there it is. Mary Magdalene was bouncing on the seat, reading the sign, Welcome to Kentucky, the bluegrass state. She felt Eli looking at her and turned and saw his eyes soften. Well, here we are, girl. He put the car in neutral and pulled up the handbrake. I swear you don't look happier than a tick on a fat dog. She laughed. I wish I had a Kodak. I'd snap me a picture of that Cinda Aunt Sugar. Eli was chuckling now. You sure you want to cross that line? Sure as I'm alive, I do. Well, if you ain't having misgivings, we best get moving. The trailer lurched along behind them as he pulled back onto the road and drove into Kentucky. Mary Magdalene sat forward on the edge of her seat, eagerly looking at all that lay before her.
That's right.
Oh, a couple of laugh-out-loud moments there.
Yeah,
that's when right. First read
happy as a tick on a fat dog.
Yeah. Yeah. Looked like the cheese slid off your cracker.
And squashed.
I just thought that was
what
a great icebreaker. You know, she's like sitting there thinking, I wish you'd say something. Yeah. You know, and there's this awful mood and you feel like you're there in the truck with them. And then she's suddenly thought, I know what I'll say.
Well, I was studying the map, preparing my manuscript, and I realised that looks like a squash frog.
So it's not a well-known thing.
It looks like a boot.
It just
occurred to me when I
was looking at it. Brilliant content, but you know, the writing as well, you know, the local roads all snarled around the main roads, all going somewhere, but it was brilliant.
Just that description in the first paragraph as well, Eli, just conveys the sort of the mood, the monotony, the slow, and then that lovely change in the whole tone and mood. At the end, and the excitement at the end is
she's irresistible, isn't she?
The only thing that worries me a bit was I think he's worried a toothpick before.
Have you worried a toothpick before? Well, that's one of the
things. It was a familiar phrase, as if I've read it before.
Really?
So I don't know if you've used it before.
I thought at the beginning that this was the scene where he is called, he gets his call.
Yes,
he was probably similar. But of course, they are sitting in a truck a lot of the time.
That's when that happened.
That was my only question. Yeah. That's the only thing I've found about it, that I just thought, I've seen that before. I've read that
and
before.
He's got one little niggle.
Really? What's that?
Third paragraph. She wished Eli would say something. He'd been uncommonly quiet since last night. She hadn't meant to hurt his feelings, but all that scared, mad, anxious emotion bottled up inside her exploded into a real hissy fit. It just didn't sound like Mary Magdalene.
Well, isn't this after the fight in the diner?
I'm not denying that that's not that's what she
felt.
Feeling.
That would be
just
her
the
language.
Expression. Sounded too much like a third party.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I see what you mean. Yeah. Would she admit to being scared?
You know what? I don't know if she would or not. Mm. No, I think I should work on that because she's usually not. She doesn't lose it very much. She's angry at him.
Yeah. It's just the way. Yeah. It's just the words. It's not the emotions.
Right. What is hissy fit particularly?
No.
It's the scared, mad, anxious.
It's the self-knowing. This is the problem. It's the self-knowing. Mostly, we're not that aware of our own motivations. Yeah. I think that's...
And this is third person closed.
Yeah.
So we have to have the description of how Mary Magdalene is feeling in her own words.
Yes.
Right.
Okay. And it doesn't sound...
Would she admit saying... She hadn't meant to hurt his feelings, but all that scared, anxious emotion balled up inside her exploded. Mm-hmm. Would she understand she was scared and anxious?
She might.
How you just need to say all that emotion?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I just have to change it.
It's a bit awful.
She hadn't meant to hurt his feelings, but he was as annoying as one of her colourful metaphors, you know.
And I thought which he had was redundant.
I know it is, but I like that. He hadn't only done this, which he had, but he also did this. Okay. Thank you anyway.
Yeah, that sounds like very bad, which he had. But it's also, I thought was lovely, is we're seeing a little warm moment between Mary Magdalene and Eli. And we haven't had that, you know, we've seen the conflict in their relationship, but we also, you know, they're bound to be very close. They've only got each other. And so it's nice to see that warm moment when he actually pulls over and he recognises that she's excited and encourages her in that feeling.
What about you, Helen? I just want to know what's happened to the money.
I want to know what's happened to the money.
Well, I keep expecting the next bit of read going to tell me.
As you know, I asked some of our listeners, they wrote on our Facebook group, what happened to the money? And boy, we got some really good suggestions for what they thought had happened to the money. So I have decided which one of those I'm going to use, and you'll just have to wait and see.
I hope it's mine.
Are you
going
to get a small prize? A free copy of the book when it's published.
Oh, absolutely. That might be
the royalties.
No, that's going too far.
People could die before that. We don't want that. Brilliant. Yeah, but thanks for all those suggestions. And Heather, I want to see how it works. It's a lot of fun to work with Eli and Mary Magdalene.
Yeah.
Because really, literally anything could happen, couldn't it? Yeah.
So now it's over to Heather with your word of the week.
Flippity gibbet, which I have to confess, before I actually looked it up, I thought it was flippity.
Ah.
Peas and not be. So it's a Middle English word referring to a flighty or whimsical person, usually a young woman. In modern use, it's used as a slang term, especially in Yorkshire, for a gossip or overly talkative person.
Right.
Some understand it to be a sailing reference relating to a torn mainsail, which flapped loudly with little effect on anything. Since the yardarm on a sailing vessel is a gibbet, used for hanging, it makes sense. It is mentioned in The Sound of Music.
Uh-huh.
Maria, flibbity gibbet, a will-o'-the-wisp, a clown.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's also thought to mean fly-by gibbet. The scaffold where the bodies of executed criminals were left to rot.
Oh,
no doubt these attracted crows and other carrion feeders. Presumably, the inferred meaning is flighty, and possibly in a more sinister sense than its current meaning.
Ooh. And also, I thought it was in The Wizard of Oz, but I thought it was the name of a creature or something, but I don't know. I may have just dreamt that.
Well, one of the sails on a boat is a jib.
Yes, that's
so.
We like the cut of your jib.
Now, just how do you move a character from one scene to another, especially if you don't want to go into a lot of boring detail about driving routes or bus timetables? What about moving your characters across time and space? Just where did you leave those dilithium crystals? So Linda's going to help us on this one because she's going to lead a little mini workshop on transitions in writing.
Well, I'm going to help with the help of all of you. But transitions are like street signs, I think, and they will tell you where you're going to go. I found this bit on, I think it was a pro writing aid or a program that comes with Word on the computer, and it says to imagine a road with no street signs. How would you know the right route if you didn't have a sign showing you which way to go? So transition words are the road signs in writing. So helping your reader follow your train of thought without becoming bogged down is what you really want to do. So here's an example. Mark avoided the campus dining hall where his ex-friends hung out, period. He didn't like the food. And so a better way of putting it so that you actually know that these two things are related is Mark avoided the campus dining hall where his ex-friends hung out, period. Equally important, he didn't like his food. So it kind of ties it together a lot more smoothly than without it. And you have a lot of other words that you can use. I think we've looked at some of those. But similarly, nevertheless, in order to, likewise, as a result, there are many ways that you can do a good transition. And one of them is changing the chapter. Right, Steph?
Yeah, well, readers know that things are shifting to another time or place when they see a chapter end and a new one beginning. So you might end a chapter with a phone call saying to Mavis, your friend's died. And the next one could open with, until the day of the funeral, Mavis still wasn't sure what to wear. You don't have to go through all Mavis's grief and
all the days
all
in
the
between.
Days in right, between. Right. But you could just say, until the day of the funeral, Mavis still wasn't sure what to wear, which is a sort of subtle way of showing that time's passed.
Right.
And probably, I would argue, more subtle than saying, as dawn broke on the day of the funeral. That's a bit of a cliche,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's very helpful learning about these things, because when I was beginning writing, and actually till recently, I guess, I felt really that I needed to show the character moving from one place to another, like he's sitting on the couch, and I would want to move him through the door, into the kitchen, up by the counter, et cetera, which is really going to be quite boring and waste a lot of time. But I wasn't comfortable not doing it. But now that we've studied some more about using transitions, you can see how well it works just to say, you know, you leave him sitting on the couch, and the next time you can just have him in the kitchen at the counter doing whatever he's doing. And, yeah, so this, until the day of the funeral, Mavis still wasn't sure what to wear, is much better than going through, she hung up the phone, and she cried, and she grieved, and 3 days she was wearing black, and et cetera. It's much better that way.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the other ways you would transition techniques you could use. One would it be, what if you're breaking a scene but you're not in a different chapter?
Well, some writers actually put a row of dots across the page or some stars or some sort of physical barrier that shows you. The way I've been taught to do it is that you indent the paragraphs in a section, and then when you go to a new section, you don't indent that first paragraph. Mm.
Yeah.
And you leave an extra space.
Mm-hmm.
So that signals...
Subtle
that,
visual clue.
Yeah, that signals that you've moved to a new section.
Is there any rules on when you should use a break like that rather than move to another chapter?
Mm. It's a judgment, isn't it?
It's a judgment.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's
a different scene.
It's about the cohesion.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Would you like an example from
my
own
work? I would.
Okay, this is from a story I wrote some time ago. Called Hotel Grand Britannia, which is a hotel in Athens. But it concerns an archaeologist, Miranda, and she's in a trench digging, but then there's a lot of flashback. So if I read you, I've done exactly what Steph said, leave a blank line and then not indent the paragraph. So the last sentence of one section is, she rubbed the encrusted dirt carefully with her finger and trembled as she saw the glint of yellow metal. Then there's a blank line, and we start with a non-indented paragraph, the next sentence. A golden bauble sparkled with reflected light as it slowly turned in the draft. Miranda sat close to the Christmas tree in the Hotel Grand Britannia.
Mm.
I'm not saying it's a good example, but that's how I've used it.
I think it's a lovely example, because you've got the glint at light at the end of one section, which kind of chimes with the bauble, or the golden ball, in the next section. So you've got that kind of link in that respect.
Right.
But as you say, you can visually see that it's a different section. And
we're clearly
moving not
on to
told
something
that
else.
She's packed up and gone to the Hotel Britannia. She suddenly appeared there.
In fact, it could be years later that she's watching the ball.
Yeah.
Couldn't
it? Well, it's actually a flashback, but if you were reading the story, hopefully you'd get that.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit abstract, taking out context.
That's a very good example of the gap between the passages.
Another technique is to summarise the time. Nicola, I think you had an example for that.
Yeah, we just read The Wasp Factory by Ian Banks for our book club, and this example goes as follows. I spent the rest of the day in the house reading books and magazines, watching television and thinking all the time. I could not do anything about Eric from the inside, so I had to change the direction of my attack. Yes, right, we don't have to be bored by all the bits, all the detail of what he ate, what he read, what he watched, but we are treated to a snippet of his preoccupations.
A summary paragraph of work if you don't want to break the scene, but you want to show a passage of time without breaking the tension of the story flow. Mm-hmm. I think we have an example of that. Stephanie, would you?
Yeah. Right, so this is a paragraph from The Woman's Room by Marilyn French, and it's set in 1955. Myra and Norm were worried about the down payment on a small house they wanted to buy in Mayersville. Norm had finished his internship and had entered as an assistant in the practice of an old friend of the family. He had wanted to go on with his training. He wanted to specialise, but he couldn't bear living another year in that tiny apartment cooped up with the kids. With the help of their parents, they bought a small house in the suburbs. It had two bedrooms and a dining room. Myra was thrilled, even though they had no furniture. The relatives swept out their attics and the young couple were established. So right. That's quite a lot has happened to this couple. You know, you've got 2 years of work and building a house and the rest of it, and you've done it all in a couple of sentences.
You summarised it very nicely.
Yeah.
And now you can go on.
Move on. Whereas, you know, going, they went around looking at houses and then they found one and then they borrowed the money and, gets
painful
a bit dull,
details
doesn't
move the plot on
But we do need to know.
Yes, we do.
Yes. Is that something we can just leave out? Mm-hmm. This is a wonderful way to summarise it and get back to the story without losing your reading.
I got very bogged down with all of this. I read all of the information that had been sent out and I related it to a story that I've written that I've now gone back to for the first time. And it's about the character's called George, and it starts off where he's on his own, and I've put George is tired, lonely and sad. He couldn't understand why he was on his own or what was happening to him. He tried to shout for Vile Victor, but he didn't have the strength. He leaned back in his chair and tried to gather his wits. And he thought about his life. And the whole thing is, I've put that in italics because it's going to move from him sitting in a house on his own and thinking back about his life. Mm-hmm. And I tried to put some of the things in that we read and some of the methods of transition, because obviously it's going to be a transition each time from him to what he's thinking about. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I've actually come up
with
an
answer. Well, I think italics is another way. It's a mark of change.
And the bit where you said sometimes people, you know, do a dotted line or whatever, I just wondered whether that was something that would be okay for a reader to see.
I think as long as you're consistent in your style, it doesn't really matter, does it?
It's
signalling to the...
I mean, I will be using this as a critique for future.
So are all of the... Every time you go back to what his thoughts are, is that going to be like a flashback? Is he going to be flashing back? Or
the whole premise of the story is that he's in his house on his own and nobody's coming in to see him. Nobody's doing anything.
Right.
So he's sitting there on his own and he's thinking about the past and his son and his wife. And
the italics mark a different narrative voice, if you like. I think that's good. I think that's fine.
Well, another technique that's mentioned is to do a montage. Pat, do you want to give an example?
Yeah, I think montage is useful when you want to show a character spending a long time doing something monotonous. And then a short paragraph with lots of details to pull the reader into the next scene works quite well. So Melvin Bragg's Soldier's Return. He describes Sam's gradual assimilation into the town on his return from war. As ever was, the men were there, killing time, loitering, pushed out or glad to be out of cramped houses, leaning against the railings, watching and marking the town go by, now and then squirting out a spit, sometimes hitting one of the dogs which lurched about. They knew Sam and nodded or greeted him unexcitedly, most of them remarking on how well he looked, as if he'd come back from a holiday. Their indifference to his war made him smile to himself. There was a kind of settlement in it, perhaps even a wisdom. This was the fulcrum of the town.
he took his place.
That's a very good example.
Yeah,
it's a montage of all the men lounging around.
It shows a routine. This is every day, every day, day after day after day.
So I'm still not grasping it fully. Would another example of a montage be your scene in the Capernaum when you talk about time?
It could be. I didn't bring that along with me today because I brought this story instead. But I think there are examples in that, you know. I the clock ticked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever, I can't remember.
The tea was drunk.
The coffee was drunk.
Yeah.
The beads were rattled.
So it is particularly useful, I think, when you are describing a scene that is
monotonous, repetitive.
Tiny little specific details like squirting out a spit, sometimes hitting one of the dogs which lurched about, I think really builds a wonderful picture in the mind of these lounging.
It reminds me of Nicholas, where the elders were. Well, she said that her shift was so damp with sweat,
it was like
one of the elders had spat on her back or something.
Yeah, well, in this example, you can pretty much see, it seems to me that I can see the whole town somehow within all of the things that are mentioned here. Just get the attitude and the tone of what was going on.
So essentially a montage is dissecting the essence of what makes something what it is and then pithily sort of summing it up in a little list.
It's like a list, this and this and this.
Yeah, okay.
Right. You know, but without actually describing each thing in detail.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a handy-dandy little one.
It is. I like montages. I should build some montages.
We'll all be doing it all the time now.
And then there's one where we drop the readers off and pick them up again. So that's like ignoring the passage of time and showing or telling the reader that something's going to happen and then skip ahead.
Yeah, I did that. I found an example earlier in my Mark story where I did that, where early on where Mark is deciding whether or not he's going to go back to Marianne and Peter's. In fact, Mark had been standing at the corner of the street for 10 minutes. He didn't think he could do this, but something, a feeling he didn't understand, was drawing him back. I'll just do today, he thought. That Peter doesn't want me here anyway. He'll probably sack me off as soon as he can. And before he could change his mind again, he was knocking at the door in a double space.
Yeah, yeah.
By lunchtime, he cleared a section of the small vegetable plot at the end of the garden and prepared for the new season's planting.
Yeah,
so you don't have to have them answering the door, inviting him in, showing him where the tools are.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Same way he moved from the end of the road to the front door in one fell swoop, didn't he?
And the reader is completely comfortable with that. There's no problem.
Yeah. Right. So transitions serve us in so many ways by keeping things moving without being boring or boring the reader. Yeah. And then how about reminding the reader that time has passed? How do you think you do that?
I've got an example again in this story that I brought along today. I don't know. So in the first paragraph, it says it was well past noon, and then further on in the story she's continuing to work in the trench, and then we have all these flashbacks and things, and it says she stood up straight and looked around for Andoni. It was not quite two, she estimated, so she's judging by the sun and her work pattern. So that shows in those four pages that time, a couple of hours have passed her working. Again, I'm not saying it's a good example, what I did.
I've got an example from The Woman's Room by Marion French again, which I think is quite a good one. It says, 2 years ago, she had been her own person. Her mind was her own, a clear, clean space for working out clear, clean, interesting problems.
Okay.
Which is, I think, showing us that she's no longer her own person. In 2 years, she's gone and become a bit of a fruitcake and a fancy gibbet.
Reminding that time has passed by actually referring to time. In yours, it was the clock you were looking at. And here, she's remembering two years ago.
Or you could do something like she swept her hand through her graying hair. To show a long period of time, so perhaps.
Right. Yeah, so those are all good ways to do transitions.
So change the chapter.
Yeah.
break the scene.
Right.
Summarise the time.
Do a montage.
Yeah. Drop the readers off and pick them up again. I like that one.
Yeah.
And remind the reader time has passed.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm quite keen on that, drop the readers off and pick them up again, because I can, you know, especially with space travel, it takes awful long, you know, light years, and that would be terribly, terribly dull.
It's getting that balance, isn't it? It's eliminating the unnecessary, boring detail.
Yes.
By choosing and focusing on the really sort of pertinent detail or
what the reader needs to know.
What they need to know, and what will just crystallise the scene or the moment or character.
Yeah, I was just going to say, to a certain extent, we're doing that instinctively. I mean, it's not instinctive, it's learned from our reading and our experience of books and our practice of trying to be writers and so on.
Yeah.
But we're kind of using a technique without knowing we are, or knowing that it has a name.
Yeah. But in a conversation sometimes we'll say, to make a long story short.
Yeah.
And basically, in writing, that's what transitions are doing.
Yeah.
Without actually saying the words.
Right.
As you say, it's what we pick up from reading. And,
Or the expression, cut to the chase.
Yes. Yeah. I go back to teaching again, and the thousands and thousands of essays that I read were about, our family holiday or something.
Yeah.
And it was getting up, getting some breakfast, the conversation, everyone get to move on and ready, and then and then they get to the end of their like 2 or 3 pages, which they think is probably enough. And they're just setting off in the car.
And then we went to Disneyland and had a lovely time.
Yes. And that's exactly what we sort of.
Just imagine your surprise if somebody started in media res. They would have got so many brownie points. Well, that was great. I'm sure we all feel much more confident in moving our characters along now. Well, that's nearly it for this week, but before we go, there's just time for Pat and Neil Fawcett to tell us what they're reading at the moment. So, Pat, what's on your bedside table?
Well, you remember a couple of weeks ago we were talking about detectives, and I had read sort of the first two in this particular series, and I thought, actually, I never got to the third one, and so I finally got around to it, and it's now on my bedside table, and that's Career of Evil. By J.K. By Robert Galbraith, which is for J.K. Rowling.
Oh, really?
Of course. And it's Cormoran Strike, Book 3. Cormoran Strike is her detective. Mm-hmm. He's a former soldier who has lost a leg. Has been told
that. Yes.
Yeah, and I did see this on television. Mm. And I'm having to say that the book is a lot better. They've done the characters very well. Having read the first two books, I think the actual realisation of the characters and casting is done particularly well, though I have a feeling that she's perhaps a little bit prettier than she's portrayed in the book. But the relationship between them is really sort of well done. He's quite perfect, I think. But so much of what we said about the detective and, you know, the sort of quirks and
the sidekick,
things that are sidekick, and so on. But this is good. It's a mysterious package is delivered to Robin, the assistant, and when she opens it, she finds it's a woman's severed leg.
Oh,
quite macabre.
Someone's attention, isn't it?
But well written,
and
the characters are very engaging.
I can't imagine that you're reading things about people with severed legs being delivered just before you're going to go to sleep.
Yeah.
In marketing terms, that's called lumpy mail.
Lumpy mail?
If you send something through the post to get someone's attention and it's not flat, it's called lumpy mail.
Really?
You don't get much lumpier than a leg, do you?
Oh, yeah.
Now, Neil, what's on your bedside table?
It's a collection of the works of a Chilean writer called Roberto Bolaño. He's unfortunately, he's been dead a number of years. He was only 50 when he died. His primary genre was prose, but he much preferred to write poetry. He thought that was his art form. He enjoyed writing poetry more than prose. Although he's a prolific prose writer, he puts me in mind of the American beat poets, very much like Charles Bukowski, that kind of style. And I love it. It's immediate, it's engrossing, and it suits my style. So I'm learning a lot from him at the moment.
Great. And would you recommend it to people who are just starting to get into poetry, or is it?
Yeah, I think so, because it's accessible, it's immediate, it's not complex. And that's probably why I like it.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, dear.
So just before we go, if any of you are attending the Winchester Writers Festival on the 15th, 16th, 17th of June, make sure you collect your free Write Club the Podcast bingo card, which has several writing and reading challenges for you to enjoy. And if you haven't yet booked your place, there's still time. Booking doesn't close until the 12th of June, and there are still a few places left. Just go to writersfestival.co.uk for the details, and we'll post the link on our Facebook group too. Well, that's it for us this week. We would greatly appreciate it if you would tell a friend about Write Club the Podcast, or just share an episode with three people who might enjoy it. And don't forget to subscribe to iTunes or Stitcher so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. And if you really want to support the podcast, you could go and download the Radio Public app and listen there, because we get a penny or two every time you listen through. That's it for this week. Thanks very much for joining us. Bye, everybody.
Bye.